think Tevez going to Juventus, what a coup that was for me. I mean,
on a head-to-head battle, Atletico Madrid can do more damage to Barcelona than the other way around.
Either he's really blind, or he's fixing the match. I can't see it any other way.
I'm trying to get Sir Bob on my side here by saying City will win the Premier League.
It is an upset. You would expect Man United to go and win there.
Over $1 billion was paid in transfer fees between the clubs in Europe.
It's football. It's damn football. Like Ferguson said, football. Bloody marvellous.
Yeah, well, the celebration was, I can't believe I just scored against Mexico.
At one point, Parma, I think it's only like 224 players under contract.
So they're going to throw me out of here, fellas. You're going to get me arrested on your show.
If you're a serious talent, you're going back and you're playing for Santos. You know, you're going back to play for, like, in Argentina for River Plate or Boca Juniors, or you're going to Europe.
He looked like the Ryan Giggs of old. He was more creative than any player on the pitch. He made Mata look stupid. He made Rooney look silly.
Now, the Premier League is the most exciting league out there. I think it's probably the best marketed league without a question.
When you look at the draw for the Champions League, you kind of say, well, all the pieces kind of fell into place for everybody except City.
I am your host, Joe Uccello.
Sir Bob, Mike Orr. My co-host, Rob Rojas.
My trusted co-host, Ben the Machine.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to episode 305 of Low Limit Football on this 14th of November, 2020. I'm your host, Joe Uccello, and tonight we are in the middle of the last international break of the season as Nations League winds down and CONMEBOL World Cup qualifiers heat up. The U.S. men's national team returns to action for the first time since February. We'll look in and see how they did against Wales. Liverpool's Joel Gomez goes down with an injury while on national team duty. What does this mean for Liverpool? And we'll take a deeper dive into the Bundesliga with our very, very special guest, Mr. Chris Williams, analyst for the DFL World Feed, who will be joining us in just a little bit. But first, as always, let me get my co-host in here, Mr. Roberto Rojas. How are you, my friend?
Good, Joe, good. And actually happy that the election is over. And yes, officially over, I should say.
You know, I would stand to correct you a little bit, because it is not officially over until the votes are certified in December. However, I will say that it is mathematically over. And
so it's like a CONMEBOL World Cup qualifier, essentially.
Yeah.
It's like trying to qualify into the top five.
Yeah, like Bolivia still has to play Venezuela for the 11th and 12th spot, but the top five are already decided. So that's exactly what it means, you know, for me. And thankfully, I would say, right, there has, you know, for me, from what I've seen personally, especially on social media, there is a lot of angst. And I think that will continue to be. And I'm hoping that as these things begin to finalize themselves, that angst will start to go away. I don't feel like it actually will, unfortunately, but I am hoping that it will start to go away and people will return to some semblance of civility, because right now, if you are big on the social media and you are watching all the time, it's a catastrophe. And
toxic is the right word.
Toxic is absolutely the right word. And it is, you know, I've seen people on both sides basically that have said that it has been so bad that they've just taken a break, just totally not looked at social media. Unfortunately for me personally, a lot of the things that I follow in world football are things that especially people that I follow on social media, because I'm going to pull, you know, so-and-so's information from Germany and so-and-so's information from Spain. And I'm constantly there looking for that. And I've become very, very, skilled at being able to scroll through the dreck to get to those pieces that I need to be able to continue to follow the football in the way that I want to follow it. So, yeah, hopefully it's done. I mean, your thoughts, my friend, is it finally done?
Yeah. I mean, yeah. It's kind of like, I made the joke on Twitter the other day about how, Trump won North Carolina, and I DM'd you the reference of that's basically the goal of – that's like the Austria goal in the 7-1 loss against Germany. So, yeah, it's over. I mean, certainly there are going to be people that are going to dispute and say it's a fraud, it's a fix from the Democrats, et cetera, et cetera. Mm. But, hey, the numbers are there. The math is there. And you can't fault math, I guess.
No.
So, yeah, no. But unfortunately, there are going to be people that are just going to be like this constantly for quite some time, but thankfully it's always about just following the right people. And if you don't, I mean, that's where there's a simple unfollow, block, mm-hmm. mute, whatever. You don't want that kind of toxic vibe, yeah. Scrolling through social media when all you want to do is like check out the latest, you know, it's bad to say this, but maybe the latest injuries of a player or the scores of a game in South America, that kind of thing.
And I've got to say, just to tie us back to football and bring us back to the show, every time you reference that Oscar goal or you reference that result from the World Cup, all I can think of is that football jersey on the back with the name on the back that is Te Comiste and then the number 7. I have that picture burned in my mind and it makes me chuckle every time I think about
I
it.
I sent you that photo, didn't I?
Yes, you did. Yes, you did. You said years ago.
No, Copa America, Argentina against Venezuela.
Yeah.
It was that
game. That was 2019.
So, no, 2016.
16. That's right. Cause that was the 2014 World Cup when that happened.
Exactly.
Yes. So 26. So like I said, years ago, and in coronavirus time, it was actually a century ago, but
exactly.
We digress. let's jump into it, my friend. Before we hit our opening thoughts topic, you have the trivia question today.
I do. So, obviously going into kind of hinting our opening thoughts, Brazil defeated Venezuela yesterday by a score of 1-0, mm-hmm. which gives Chichi, the manager, its 13th win as head coach of Brazil in the World Cup qualifiers. So 13 wins in the World Cup qualifiers, 2 draws, 40 goals in favor, 5 against, and 41 points of a possible 45. So just incredible numbers for Chichi in the World Cup qualifiers.
Mm-hmm.
So having said that, with Brazil's 41 points ever since Chichi took in charge, can you name me the 4 other teams that come after that, after them, in the rankings ever since Chichi took in charge? So basically just name me the 4 countries in South America who've gained the most points ever since Chichi came in charge of Brazil.
In Chichi's time. Okay, so it's 4 teams. Okay, I think. Okay, I absolutely know one of them. Okay. I would absolutely know 2 of them.
Bonus points if you can get them in order.
Wow. I think I might be writing them in order. Wow. All right, I've got to think about the 3rd and the 4th team. Because okay. I think I actually have the top 2 in order right now. So we'll see. So
And this obviously counts the games that happened yesterday
on the weekend. Thursday. Yes, okay. But obviously not matches that are coming up, which we'll give you in matches of the week later on. And we'll also give you the trivia question at the same time. So let's go into opening thoughts, my friend. And of course, opening thoughts is going to be the CONMEBOL World Cup qualifiers. I know that the Nations League matches going on in Europe are quote unquote meaningful, but certainly in terms of biggest matches in the world right now, these are the ones, the South American World Cup qualifiers. And to give you a rundown as to the results after match day 3, like you said, Rob, Brazil beat Venezuela 1-0. It was a Firmino goal in the second half. Chile with 2-0 over Peru with a brace by Arturo Vidal. Uruguay with, I think, what you and I might actually call an upset early on in this particular match or in this particular qualifying. Uruguay 3-0 over Colombia in Colombia. Colombia picking up a red card in that one and goals by, of course, Suarez and Edson Cavani. You know, who else would score? Argentina-Paraguay in a physical match that I definitely want to talk to you about. 1-1 draw. And the final match, Ecuador, I believe overcoming a 2-0 deficit to Bolivia and winning that one 3-2. So where we stand right now in World Cup qualifying after 3 matches, Brazil still perfect. They are on 9 points after three matches, only conceded two goals, and they've scored 10. Argentina second on 7 points. Ecuador third on 6 points. Uruguay fourth on 6 points. Paraguay in that qualifying spot right now on 5 points. They are still unbeaten as well. Chile in sixth, tied with Colombia with 4 points each. Peru in eighth on 1 point. And Venezuela and Bolivia are yet to pick up a point in qualifying. Venezuela are yet to even pick up a goal. Let's start there with Venezuela, Rob. I want to get your opinion because obviously losing Joseph Martinez is massive. We've seen what it's done to Atlanta United and MLS. Is this the big piece that's missing for Venezuela right now?
Oh, I think even bigger than that is just the new coach. I think Jose Peseiro, you know, obviously has had a great track record in Portugal and managing teams all around the world. But I think he's just someone that is just so poor and dull defensively, and you know it shows when you've seen that they haven't scored a single goal in three games. Mm-hmm. And so I think that becomes the issue for them. And yes, Joseph Martinez is a huge loss for Venezuela, but you know they still have the likes of a Salomon Rondon, a Darwin Machis, who's been doing great at Granada this season, Joe. Mm-hmm. You know, Yango Herrera, Savarino, you know, many talented, Fardinhas, the goalkeeper. You know, you have many young players on this side, but unfortunately, just the way that Peseiro has set them up has not been working. I mean, yeah, they have been giving a tough schedule. I think certainly, you know, the loss against Colombia away, you know, barely losing to Paraguay, and you know, it had to take, you know, it was a goal in the last minute. But if you remember, Venezuela had a penalty in the last minute to tie the game, and Machis, and the penalty was saved. Mm-hmm. So clearly, they could have easily gotten a point there. Then the loss against Brazil, a game that actually Venezuela were kind of unfortunate not to get a point. I think, you know, I was watching the game and, you know, Brazil were constantly just starting to slowly attack later on in the second half. And I think that's when they started to break through and get the goal that they needed. So, yeah, kind of unfortunate that they weren't able to get a single point or even a goal at the moment. You know, they have their next game against Chile at home. And, you know, Chile are trying to bounce back after losing their first game and then tying against Colombia. So, yeah, I mean, I think they have been very unfortunate that, you know, this generation of players is not managed properly. I think, you know, I certainly didn't expect them to be in the situation now. I mean, you know, three games is still too early, but, you know, it just does seem a bit frustrating that, you know, you go into your first three games with probably your most talented Venezuela side ever in the history of the country, and they're not able to get a single goal yet. So yeah, it's very troubling. And as bad as I really want to see Venezuela make the World Cup, because you know they're the only side in South America to never made it to a single World Cup, I think they're going to miss it much earlier than before. And it's sad to say that, because they obviously went to a U-20 World Cup final. You know, they make teams struggle in a way. I mean, they've made it difficult for some teams. So, yeah, it's I don't know where I see this for Venezuela. But again, it's still early. South America for a reason. Anything can happen. You don't expect these five teams that we're seeing right now are going to make the World Cup. So we just got to wait and see, and hopefully that they can turn it around and to make it more competitive.
I want to turn my focus now to Colombia. In fact, you know, when we started World Cup qualifying here, their first match was against Venezuela, a big rivalry match. And you and I talked about it, and I was very, very confident. In fact, I think I even predicted a 3-0 victory, and you were certainly less than enthusiastic about the prospects of Colombia winning big or even winning, if I remember correctly. Mm-hmm. And I actually got one on you, because Colombia did win 3-0 over Venezuela, but since then, it's been a bit of a struggle. They draw Chile 2-2, and then they lose to Uruguay just the other day. 3-0, I think, was a little bit of a shock, especially given the age of guys like Suarez and Cavani. You know, the guys, they're talismen who are their goal scorers, their big people that they've survived on through the years. Colombia went from challenging for that top spot with Brazil to now, right now, sitting outside the box. Now, I think this Colombian side is too talented, and I don't think that they're going to stay there forever. And you also think about, you know, the fact that they did catch an Uruguay side that really was desperate on the week. They had to go to Chile to play, so there's a little bit of travel. And their schedule has been a little, I would say, on the softer side. Still haven't faced Argentina, still haven't faced Brazil. You know, these are tough places to play. They still haven't gone to altitude for Ecuador and Bolivia. Can this Colombia side turn it back around quickly and get back into the top five?
I mean, they certainly have the talent to do so. I think, unfortunately, you know, in the game yesterday, which, by the way, Joe, I told you this, it's their worst ever loss at home, given that Colombia have, have always been strong in the heat of Barranquilla and have always used that as kind of their home field advantage. Mm-hmm. To get a 3-0 loss against Uruguay is awful. It's really bad. You know, I think we saw a side that just, you know, came out with a conservative mindset and just started slow. You know, they conceded a goal early from Cavani, and I think just those kind of individual errors and the lack of structure was able to have Uruguay be more advanced and, you know, try to create much more space and just be risky, to say the least. I mean, they definitely need that structure. I mean, they have a talented amount of players. I mean, you know, we know these names from years of experience, you know, like James Rodriguez, Juan Cuadrado, Duván Zapata, Luis Muriel, Luis Diaz. I mean, I can go on. Mm-hmm. But it's just the amount of structure that needs to be placed on all of these players and what they can do to go forward. I think Queiroz understands the side that he has. I mean, you know, they have a tough game against Ecuador in Quito, which obviously Quito is a tough place to get points from, if you're any team, basically. So I would like to think that they would turn around. I mean, I don't think they'll get a major setback this early. Mm-hmm. But no, I think they understand that, hey, you know, this path is tough for everyone, honestly. Like, yeah, you know, it doesn't matter if you're Colombia, Brazil, whatever. I think they know that, you know, you're not guaranteed qualification or elimination just off 3 points. But I think it's just a case of gaining consistency, and they need to get those points, because if they start losing back and losing points and other teams come back, then it just makes it more difficult for them to be in a position to qualify. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's how I see it. And I think Colombia are too good to not make the World Cup. I'm not saying that this is the prediction that's saying, hey, they're going to make the World Cup, but I just think that they're always going to be in that consideration. But I think they need to turn it around now, because, you know, you don't want to fall very deep. You don't want to be in a situation come next year when you're 13 games in, and, you know, you're still not in a position to even qualify for the World Cup. So right. No, I think they just need to gain more momentum and get the points needed, especially away from home, because I think those are even more valuable, and to be strong at home, because I think that's the thing. Like, you can't afford to lose points and drop points at home, because that's the one where, you know, it just makes it more difficult. I mean, assuming, let's take a guess, Joe. Let's say Colombia had to play 7 more games at home. Mm-hmm. That's 21 points. To make the World Cup, you need, let's put 26, 27. So out of those 21, you need at least 2 wins away. I'm assuming Colombia have the potential and the capacity to get 2 points away from home. So that's where I see it, and that's where, you know, we talk about math all the time since the beginning of the show. Yeah. It's useful. It is definitely useful when it comes to these type of qualification process.
Yeah, and if you have a home advantage like you do in Barranquilla, that you really need to take advantage of it. So the loss to Uruguay is massive on multiple levels, because Uruguay was a team that if the result was reversed, you would literally see an Uruguay side right now that would be scratching their heads trying to figure out how do they get back into the top five. Now instead, it's more of a Colombia head scratcher instead of the Uruguayan head scratcher. Let's move on to the probably, I think, the most physical match of the weekend, which was Argentina-Paraguay. Loads of controversy in this one. This was, you know how every once in a while you and I will text each other, CONMEBOL gonna CONMEBOL? This was the CONMEBOL gonna CONMEBOL match. Ends in a 1-1 draw. There was a Lionel Messi goal that was wiped out from VAR on a foul that probably was committed a minute to a minute and a half before the actual goal. It was one of those things that was insane. There was We have injury. We have red cards that should have been handed out that weren't. Let's start with the goal. And this is a question that you and I have asked since the inception of VAR. How far do you go back to review a play when a goal is scored to say that it affected the play? For me, watching this replay, this was quite possibly the most ridiculous reversal of a goal I've ever seen in my life. The foul was committed, I want to say it was on the Argentinian side of midfield. Either way, it was right near the line. But there must have been 11 passes completed before the Messi goal. And VAR saw fit to return all the way back to that point to say there was a foul and then take away the goal. It seems insane to me. What were your thoughts on that?
Well, I'll fact check you on that and say that it wasn't a minute. It was actually 27 seconds.
Seemed like forever.
Eight passes beforehand. Yeah, no, I understand, because I think that's what VAR does to you. But yeah, it's very weird. I think certainly if it's something that affects the game deeply, then it would make sense to say, hey, you know, we got to look at this before taking the goal. But I mean, I'm looking at the foul, and it's right at the edge of the sideline of where the two managers are. And, you know, obviously I'm happy that we got the points and we could have obviously won it if we could have. But I'm just like looking at it, I'm like, maybe we got really lucky on that, honestly. Mm. It's like, yeah, VAR is, and let's be fair, Joe. I mean, it wasn't just that. I mean, you know, we talk about the physicality of the games that the fouls that we saw, you know, the foul on Valentin Romero to Ezequiel Palacios, who's going to be out for a significant amount of time. You know, the foul of Gonzalo Montiel on Miguel Almirón on the left side. I mean, yeah, it was really sketchy, honestly, this game. But like you said, yeah, very physical. You had it all. It was the ultimate shithousery game of CONMEBOL. You know, penalties, fouls, VAR reversal. You know, all that was left was probably like a dog invasion or something to just make it completely CONMEBOL. But no, it was a really physical game. And I think the referees, or at least the referee in this case and the people handling VAR, could have been much more effective, to say the least. I think certainly when you look at situations like this where you know that it really is a foul, and that could have easily been a huge, aggressively made placed foul when it comes to both Almirón and Palacios. So, yeah, again, it's weird to say, because I think there has to be a better usage of VAR. And, you know, this is but it's the interpretation of the thing as well. Mm. That's the thing. That's always been the issue, not just in South America, I think all around the world. It's like, every referee is different. I mean, obviously they're taught the same way of how to call games, but every interpretation is just different in the way that they handle a matchup. But I think in this one, I think the referee definitely did not have high stars on this one, yeah. Honestly.
So looking ahead, obviously, because we're going to close up the segment in momentarily here, we've got matches coming up on Tuesday. I know we have one of them chosen as the match of the week for the qualifiers before they return to qualifying in March, the end of March. Believe it, we go that far out now. What are the storylines you're looking at going into match day four of qualifying? You know, where are the key matches, or where are the key focuses for the group, so that, you know, maybe some teams that need to maintain their momentum, some teams need to turn things around. What are the things you're looking forward to on Tuesday?
Well, we have three games. I mean, we have three teams unbeaten so far. You know, three teams that haven't lost a single game: Brazil, Argentina, which was expected, I think, and Paraguay, which even for me, did not expect them to go into the situation unbeaten. You know, certainly, I think some of the storylines will be how dominant Brazil can be. In terms of this group, I think they are far from the best team out of all the 10 teams in this process. Argentina, I mean, look, as I said, you don't want to lose points at home. I mean, you know, I think we'd mentioned this with Tim Vickery back last month, where, you know, for all the attacking power that they have, there is no kind of shape on this Argentina side, where they've only scored, what, four goals in three games or something like that?
Correct.
Yeah, they definitely need to look into just trying to find that kind of momentum. And yeah, it's all good to get two wins and a draw, but, you know, you have other teams that are coming up full steam who have scored more goals, and, you know, and I think they know deep down that they want to make the World Cup. Paraguay, let's see if, I mean, they play Bolivia next, a team that they've never lost to at home ever in World Cup qualifying. I even said this back on my other podcast, What Any Vision, where it's important, and I think it's very good to have history on your side, but usually when it comes to that, you know, teams, unfortunately, they get complacent, they get arrogant, and they think it's a secured 3 points because it's against a side that hasn't won a single game yet. But usually when it comes to those games, it's where teams have it much more tough. And that happens to a lot of teams, not just in South America. But yeah, some of the major storylines to look out for. I think obviously the big game will be Uruguay-Brazil. I think that's the classic derby between both these two teams. At the Centenario, I think Uruguay know that they can bounce back after their loss against Ecuador to get 3 points. Ecuador, on the other hand, have a really good, interesting matchup against Colombia. I mean, you know, Ecuador are starting to find their form. After their first loss, they obviously will play a Colombia side that are trying to bounce back from their loss against Uruguay. I mean, that's another one to look out for, I think. And basically, you know, I think we have to see what happens with Peru. You know, Peru have not looked as convincing as well. You know, they lost to Brazil. They tied Paraguay. They lost to Chile. Now they have Argentina next at home. I mean, if that's a perfect situation to see and take advantage of what Argentina are lacking of, then I think Peru have to take advantage of getting the result necessary. So yeah, a lot of good storylines to close the year out, Joe, and I'm really excited to see what happens.
You know, one last one I want to add is Venezuela. We've talked about them, you know, a young team, haven't scored a goal yet. It's going to be interesting to see against an aging Chile side if they can at minimum get on the scoreboard and at maximum get themselves a point or three in this one to try and get back into this race. I think that, you know, having the ability to play at home is going to be massive for them. And again, you know, Chile's not getting any younger, so we'll have to see if they can keep up with the rigors of travel over from Europe, playing these matches and then heading back. So, like you said, tons of storylines to keep an eye out for in this round four of qualifying, which is starting on Tuesday, 4 p.m. Eastern time. And we'll give you a match of the week to look at later on in the show. So let's table our discussion of the CONMEBOL World Cup qualifiers, and let's head back to Europe. Just before this recording, we were able to meet up with Chris Williams, analyst for DFL World Feed, who we got to chat with him about the Bundesliga as we start to look back at returning to normal league play, some of the things that have happened in Germany. So without further ado, the Chris Williams interview. Joining us now, analyst from DFL World Feed, Mr. Chris Williams. Chris, welcome to the show. It's great to have you on board, and I want to open quickly with questions about Hoffenheim. They obviously traveled to Slovan Liberec. This is a team in Hoffenheim that really avoided all aspects of the coronavirus from the return to the Bundesliga up till now, but had, I believe, up to 4 players currently test positive to the coronavirus. Do they attribute this to their trip to the Europa League match, or is this something that happened in Germany? What is the latest on this news on Hoffenheim?
Yeah, I mean, it's a real strange situation at Hoffenheim. I probably shouldn't laugh, but if you were to go to their club homepage on a wonderful site called Transfermarkt, you will see that every single one of their first team has got a first aid cross next to them, pretty much out with corona problems. So the squad's on, it's on a bit of a tight, you could almost call it lockdown. It's very strange. It must be a worry, because I've certainly not seen anything like this in my whole time of reporting on football. If you use different data sites and different analytics tools to go and have a look at clubs, you click on like one of them and every single first team player is regarded out, injured or unavailable. It's just something I've never, ever seen in my life. Obviously, it's a real problem. I don't think they're the first team to do that. I think RB Salzburg, Red Bull Salzburg, the other international break, locked down their squad because they had a bit of a coronavirus problem. But the coronavirus has hampered Hoffenheim a little bit in the form of Andrej Kramaric, who was in a fantastic vein of form before he contracted COVID. You know, it needs to be said that he is actually okay. He's not showing any main symptoms. He's asymptomatic, but of course he can't play, and that has really hampered them. They beat Bayern Munich quite easily. Kramaric was on the score sheet. They were very good in the games before that, but after that, they've sort of fell off because Kramaric is their main goal scorer, and they've been unable to call on him because he's been out. But yeah, at this minute, I mean, it's such a shame for them. It's a real strange situation. If I'm going to be honest, I don't think it will be the last time we see this. I mean, if we're looking now at this international break, there's players in Egypt picking it up. There's players in Brazil as well. And these are, you know, multinational players that come from all over the world, come together and play for their national side. So, yeah, it is a bit of a problem. Maybe FIFA and UEFA and all the other confederations are going to have to come together and have a look at it, because this is going to be a real problem going forward if this type of thing is going to happen when, you know, teams are playing in the Europa League or the Champions League or even during the international break.
Well, I love the quick reference back to Mo Salah and attending the wedding, because that's certainly one of the things that probably shouldn't have happened on this international break. But going back to Hoffenheim, they actually host Stuttgart on the weekend or coming up next weekend when they return back to Bundesliga action. Is that match in jeopardy, or do you think that match will actually be played?
Yeah, it most certainly is in jeopardy. I mean, if you consider that Hoffenheim are they're a medium-sized club in Germany, so they'd like to be a lot higher. They'd like to be pushing for, you know, top four, but realistically, they're somewhere between 6th and 10th in the big scheme of things. So they don't have the type of squad that Bayern or Dortmund or Leipzig can call on, or even the likes of Gladbach and Leverkusen as well. And they're just outside of that area. So when you get 6, 7, 8, 9 players affected by coronavirus, that has a real impact. I would be surprised to see it go ahead. The DFL have a number of, and the DFB, so you've got the German League and the German FA, have got a number of protocols in place. Should teams find themselves in this? The problem we have, though, is it's such a condensed season. When the Bundesliga came back, it was the first league back, as everyone will know. There was loads of redundancy in the fixture list. So had a couple of teams, in fact, there was one, there's Dynamo Dresden in the second league, couldn't play because their squad was locked down. They just simply missed a match week and they caught up later on in the schedule. That simply can't happen here. And especially because Hoffenheim are in Europe, they're playing Sunday, Thursday, Monday, Thursday. It's constant for them. There is no real redundancy. And then you've got to throw in the German Cup competitions as well, and, you know, and the two competitions that they're in already. It would be a nightmare situation for Sebastian Hoeneß and his team to find themselves maybe not playing against Stuttgart, which would help them out short term, but in long term, maybe they have to play 3 matches in 1 week. They would be in the same situation then. Their squad depth isn't good enough. You're then asking players to play high impact games, quick turnaround, and then you're going to look at some of the injuries that we've seen across, you know, the world at the minute that players are picking up. It's a real delicate situation. It will be the way German football runs. It's pretty much like no other, really. The DFL will be incumbent on the club. So if Hoffenheim say, look, we can't field a side that's worthy of a league situation, it would be almost a youth team, then the DFL will look at that and may offer them a postponement. But then it will go back to what I said earlier about where does that postponement fit into the league schedule? Because looking at the league schedule at the moment, I can't see a one at all.
And looking at the league in itself, it certainly has tightened up a bit. I mean, I know we've only been in 7 games so far at the start of the season, but we've really seen quite an interesting race. You know, looking at it real quick, we have 4 teams, the top 4 teams, separated by only 3 points. So, Chris, I just wanted to just add on to that. Part of the, not the start, but at least the first 7 games of the Bundesliga, where, you know, you have the top teams that have already lost, like Bayern Munich, Borussia Dortmund, Leipzig. Leverkusen, on the other hand, haven't lost a single game yet, even though, you know, it was always going to be interesting to see what happens after they lost their main star in Kai Havertz when he went to Chelsea. But you have Wolfsburg also that haven't lost a single game yet. I mean, it's been quite interesting, to say the least, even though some people will always go with the same conclusion that, yeah, Bayern's going to win it easily, that kind of thing. But no, it's become tight, don't you think?
Oh, yeah, it is very tight. And this is what people like me who cover the league professionally want to see, because no matter how good and how big Bayern are, when you have the same team that wins the league every single season, it does you absolutely no favours when you're either looking to grow the league. And I've spoken to some pretty big or leading industry experts in the Bundesliga who would love another club to win the league, because it just opens that up. PSG have had this, or the French league have had the same sort of problem with PSG, the Italian league slightly with Juventus. And yeah, Bayern have run away with it for as long as you can remember, really. But at the moment, yeah, they look beatable. And I attribute that to the way that they're having to play, the high level of competition that they're in Champions League. Obviously, the Pokal still and the Bundesliga, their games are coming thick and fast. Leipzig look really good this season. Julian Nagelsmann's problem last season was that they weren't picking up wins when they should have done. So they were either falling to very strange defeats or they were dropping points to draws. They look to have sort of sorted that out this season. Leverkusen's a great example. I really thought, Roberto, that they would have a problem this season, because not only have they lost Kai Havertz, they lost Kevin Volland as well. You know, real good goal scorer for them. And they've got that battle of European football coming thick and fast. But yeah, you're quite right. They haven't lost a game and they look pretty good. But just behind them, there's a real fight going on. I mean, if you look at Union Berlin, who are in their second full season now in the Bundesliga, they're in fifth position on 12th. And then Eintracht Frankfurt, they're in 11th and they're on 10 points. So that's how close the league is. And of course, it's pretty tight down the bottom as well. Arminia Bielefeld on fourth, all the way down to poor old Mainz, who've only got 1 point on the board. At the minute, it looks more reflective of the second league, which is a crazy league, really, the two Bundesliga or two dot Bundesliga or Zweite Bundesliga. You get to the end of the season and the difference between relegation and promotion can be as little as 7 points. So hopefully we'll have the same sort of situation in the main Bundesliga this year.
Definitely. And also just looking at the teams that are in the Champions League, you know, you have Bayern Munich, you have Borussia Mönchengladbach, you have RB Leipzig, and you have Borussia Dortmund, who so far are currently in pole position to qualify. I mean, certainly we still have a few more games to go, but currently they're all looking in a good position to qualify to the round of 16. Do you see that trend happening, or at least maintaining? Because I think the one big question mark will definitely be to, you know, Borussia Mönchengladbach, who haven't lost a single game yet and are in a tough group with Real Madrid, Inter, and Shakhtar Donetsk. I mean, do you see that happening, or do you feel that maybe one of these teams, depending on how they do in the remaining matches, will fall off and unfortunately miss off on qualification?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, Group B of the Champions League is probably sums up not this season and pretty much last season. It pretty much sums up the whole 2020. It's a little bit weird. You've got Inter Milan rock bottom, and then Real Madrid in third, and then Gladbach and Shakhtar Donetsk fighting it out at the top. My only worry for Gladbach is the points that they dropped early on. So had they won their other fixtures, which they should have really done, that group would have been pretty much sewn up now. They would have been pretty much like Manchester City or Liverpool, going with 9 points out of nine available. And unfortunately, they haven't. Inter Milan must be a real problem for them, I would say, being rock bottom. I can just never write off Real Madrid. I think they'll come good. I mean, the reason I think they'll come good, because if they were to end up in the Europa League, I think maybe not only their manager gets fired, but probably half the first team squad as well. That would be a real embarrassment for Real to drop into the Europa League. I think they probably want to go out of Europe completely, and that would obviously mean them finishing fourth, which would be an even bigger embarrassment. Yeah, Gladbach, if they get through, I would fear for them round about January, February time. I think the fixtures would be coming thick and fast and they'll be getting quite tired. But I mean, financially, it would give them a massive boost. And obviously, it would help the UEFA coefficient for Germany should they go through. But yeah, I mean, they are sitting pole position in a group that I didn't think they would do. And likewise, Dortmund are just about sitting on top, had a real poor performance against Lazio, but they look like they've sorted that out now. And of course, Leipzig do look really good and in a strong position to qualify, even though they got absolutely whipped by Manchester United the other week.
Absolutely, and it'll be definitely interesting to see how it goes for the remainder of the competition. But to close out for me, you know, I do want to talk about Bayern Munich again. I mean, you know, certainly they've always been on the eyes of everyone as to see, like, who can beat them, not just in Germany, but I think also in Europe and the entire world, to be fair. But they did suffer a major setback a couple of days ago with the injury of Joshua Kimmich. And, you know, for me, Chris, and Joe, I think you can agree as well. I really enjoy watching him. I think he's such a versatile player. I think he's ultra talented in that if you can put him in any position, he will succeed. So, you know, Chris, how big of a loss is this for Bayern Munich? I mean, certainly you lose that kind of versatile player that can definitely move Bayern forward. But, you know, how do they move forward now, I guess, just to say, especially now that they've dealt with injuries with Kimmich and now Alphonso Davies? I mean, you know, how big of a loss is this for the reigning European champions?
I think it's a monumental loss, and I choose that word carefully because you go back, I mean, it's probably 10 weeks ago now, Thiago was leaving, and everybody at Bayern, and I've spoken to people at Bayern, and this is pretty much their thought train. Thiago, exceptional player, you know, one of the best that's ever played for Bayern in that particular position, wanted to leave, had been a perfect servant to the club, wanted to go and try his hand somewhere else, wanted to go and work with Jürgen Klopp, left to go to Liverpool. Normally, that's not the type of thing that Bayern like. However, they were pretty much happy to agree to that because they had Joshua Kimmich I'm going to say the word reserve, but he's never been a reserve, but they had him there ready to go in that particular position. Obviously, Kimmich is, people may know him as a right back, but he prefers to play in that defensive or central midfielder role. And he has got very similar qualities to Thiago. So it was pretty much a no-lose situation for Bayern. They get to say goodbye to a fantastic player who gets a great send-off, goes to the club he wants to go to. And then all of a sudden, Joshua Kimmich gets to play a fundamental role in the centre. And now, of course, with his damage that he sustained, it's going to be a real problem. You know, meniscus damage is pretty serious. I mean, he could come back as soon as February, but it may be longer. And under a normal season, if you're out for a few months, it can be a bit of a pain, okay, especially for the rest of the squad and for the head coach. But this season, because it's congested, you know, if you were to miss a month, normally you're looking at 3 to 4 fixtures. It can be anything up to 8 to 9 fixtures in this particular season. So, yeah, it is a real problem. And they do have players who can come in and take that role in that central area. Mark Roca could start to get more of a game. Obviously, the Spanish midfielder could start to come to the fore now. Javier Martinez can, of course, play there. Goretzka can play there if they really have to. But you take out someone like Kimmich, who has got that ability to transform defence into attack very quickly, which is the way that Bayern play football. He's got his ability to spot a long or short range pass, turn defence into attack, and also score a wonderful goal as well. You take that out of a team who've already lost Thiago, and like you said, don't have Davies. Pavard's also injured. It becomes a real issue for them.
You know, I'd like to jump in because obviously we're going to talk a little bit about injuries here. You just mentioned Davies as an attacking wing back injured. Joshua Kimmich, same thing. Benjamin Pavard, same thing. Is Bayern looking at this winter transfer window coming up and possibly increase their depth with this slew of injuries at a key position for them?
Yeah, it would be interesting to see that. But one thing that Bayern don't normally do is they don't panic buy. They will try and look to within. And one thing they've been criticised a lot for in the past is maybe not trusting the academy graduates. If you look at previous Bayern sides, you know, you've got the like of Bastian Schweinsteiger. You know, you've got obviously Thomas Müller as well, who's Bavarian through and through. There's been no real pull-through. But I don't think they will go into panic buy. I think we may look at Hansi Flick, who's a very clever coach. He may look at utilising some of the players there. Now, obviously, you've got Alphonso Davies, who's a left-back. But because he plays so high, Leroy Sané could be asked to play that high role. And with the defenders, maybe just have a little bit more defensiveness about them or ask Sané to come back. It wouldn't be a natural position for him to play a high attacking wing back, but I'm pretty sure someone with his talent certainly could. And then obviously they got Kingsley Coman as well, who's a left winger. If you played Sané and Coman on that left-hand side and asked one of them just to perform that Davies role, I'm pretty sure they could get by. It wouldn't be a perfect fix because the beauty of Alphonso Davies is that he's a great attacker, but he's also a really good defender. But if you look across other teams in Europe, sometimes their attacking wing backs aren't the best defenders. They're just better attackers. So there is a little bit of redundancy in the Bayern squad. They do have a couple of people they're looking after or looking out towards, and they always do. But I'm not 100% sure how cast iron that is. And as I say, Bayern aren't the sort of team that will bring a player in for 3 or 4 months until one of their stars comes back. When they do bring somebody in, they bring them in if they're available and if it fits the profile, which is why we have the likes of Erik-Maxim Choupo-Moting come in, because Bayern need a backup to Robert Lewandowski at some point, and Choupo-Moting can be the right man in the right place and score a great goal. So that's why he came in, and he's going to be there for the remainder of the season and beyond. He wasn't just brought in as a quick fix, which is why I'd be really surprised to see Bayern go out and get somebody, because whoever they get will also know, I'm just a short fix until Davies comes back, or I'm just here until Kimmich comes back. And you're going to ask players to give up first-team football to play 3 or 4 months first-team football and then sit on the bench. It can be unrealistic.
And this is a team also, you talk about depth, that was they were able to survive the Niklas Süle injury and brought him back just towards the end of last season. So that it's certainly, we've always said they've done the right things at Bayern Munich. Here's another case in point. I do want to close, though, of course, with another injury question to you, and it goes across the channel to Joe Gomez, who was injured on international duty. This is a team, and when you look at his club team in terms of Liverpool, has already suffered the Virgil van Dijk injury, where he's out pretty much for the season. Joe Gomez underwent surgery. According to my information, it's a tendon surgery, but I've seen some reports of an ACL, so can't really get the most accurate of information out of that one, but certainly a surgical procedure on his knee that will keep him out for long term. There has been talk of David Alaba possibly moving on from Bayern Munich, and I know that you had tweeted in the past few days that David Alaba wasn't going anywhere, but could something like the Joe Gomez injury kind of put that situation into a microwave and maybe Liverpool throw a bunch of money at Bayern Munich to acquire David Alaba and possibly fill that role for them?
Yeah, I mean, it's another good question. Joe Gomez, I can sort that out for you now. But if you're unsure, he's actually had a repair to his patella tendon done, which is the tendon in the front that obviously keeps the kneecaps for the rest of the knee. Mm-hmm. So that is a real serious injury for him to come back from. Also, put it in the same. In the same problem, if you want to call it that, it's the same knee that he had his ACL damage. I mean, Joe Gomez is 23 and he's a very fit young man. I have a real concern for him, but I'm unsure whether a professional player can survive an ACL injury and then a patella tendon injury and get back to full level fitness and play at an exceptionally high level in a Premier League and a Champions League and the FA Cup and whatever other competitions Liverpool play him in. So that's my main worry for him going forward. Liverpool, I think, will be forced now into buying a centre back. They probably, if we're going to be critical, should have bought one in the summer because Dejan Lovren had left and you need some redundancy in depth. I don't think anybody foresaw an injury to both first-choice centre-backs, as in Van Dijk and Gomez. Fabinho can play there. He's obviously got his own injury problems himself. So it is a bit of a mess for Liverpool. I think someone like Alaba would quite easily fit into Liverpool's way of playing. If you're going to look at comparative styles of football across Europe, Bayern and Liverpool's is pretty much the same. I think that's a game. If both teams had a completely fit roster and we could find a full stadium somewhere, I think that is the game of football that pretty much everybody across Europe, and I will maybe even assume the rest of the world, would want to see. But would David Alaba go to Liverpool? Potentially, I suppose. You can never move anything out from a player, but he's reportedly spoke to colleagues and said if he was to leave Bayern, he'd want to go to Spain. So you would naturally assume that's either going to be Real Madrid or Barcelona. And Bayern don't want to sell. They don't want to lose him for free. But I think what the injury to Joshua Kimmich has shown them is that you don't know what's going to happen. And they will look at the likes of Liverpool and go, "Ooh, Liverpool lost their main defender. Now they've lost their second main centre-back. They've lost their natural centre-back partnership. What would happen if we let Alaba go for €25 million in the summer And then all of a sudden we get an injury to two or three key areas or areas where he could play, and that would be a real disaster for them. So on this particular instance, Bayern don't like losing players for free. But I think if they were to sell him, then have an injury problems themselves, not be able to win the Champions League or not be able to win the Bundesliga, I think the fact that they got 23 or 25 or 30 million euros in the bank wouldn't really help them with that. I think in this particular instance, they would be willing to lose a player for free if it meant that they were to keep their European and domestic crowns. So we could be in that situation. And yeah, Hansi Flick has said he wants David Alaba in his squad. He's a key member and he doesn't want him sold. And I think Hansi Flick's looking around the rest of the world and seeing players get injured and thinking, no, this isn't going to happen to us. We're not going to suffer what Liverpool have done, or we're not going to suffer, you know, what Arsenal have had, or some of the other key injuries that have happened across the whole of Europe.
Well, I think you bring up a great point, too, because you look at their defensive backs or their center backs. Like we said, Nicolas Sulla just coming off of injury, and I can't remember his exact injury, but he was out for quite a while. Jerome Boateng's 32 years old, so he's not getting any younger. And a piece like David Alaba becomes, especially given the climate, becomes much, much more valuable because of the amount of matches these players are playing now. I know that we've talked about this before. It seems to me like there has been no off time, that these players have just jumped in match after match after match, and they've really given their bodies no chance to rest. And I think it's the reason we're seeing many of these injuries start to crop up, that these players are not allowed a moment to actually heal their bodies after a rigorous 90 minutes on the pitch. And we're seeing these injuries start to pop up again now. So a player like David Alaba becomes even that much more valuable because it allows that depth, that if you do have a Nicolas Sulla go down again, or if you do have a Jerome Boateng go down, you have that depth that you can recover with, and quality at depth, okay? Whereas Liverpool right now, where they've suffered something really, if you think about it, it's catastrophic, losing their number one and number two center backs, they really don't have the ability to dump in a number three. And I'll be honest, I don't know that there are many teams in the world that could survive a loss of their best or their top two center backs and still be able to put quality back on the pitch. The only one really for me that comes to mind, and it's not even close, is Juventus. If they suffered, they've already suffered De Ligt. He's injured and he's been out for a while. They've suffered Chiellini with the ACL last year, and they were still able to even go through with a Mary Demiral that had an ACL injury as well, and they were still able to throw center backs onto the pitch and at least survive enough to win a Serie A title. So this is a catastrophic thing that I don't think there are many teams out there in the world that could survive.
No, and you're quite right. And you can't build, you can build a team, and as some teams have done this, but it doesn't work out well. You can't have 22, 23, 25 world-class players because only 11 can play at once. Okay, at the moment, you can push that out with the substitutes, and if you're playing in European competition, you can rotate five of them. See, Premier League teams can't do that still. But you will not keep anybody happy by that. So you need to have a mixture of quality, and you need to have a mixture of experience and development as well. And the likes of Bayern have got that down. Liverpool have certainly got that down. And yeah, you can't say, well, we've got two experienced centre-backs here, let's go and get another one who can just sit on the bench, because that's not going to happen. Top players want to play. It affects their ability to play in Europe. It affects their ability to play for their national side. So yeah, if you're going to lose your first two key defenders, it does become a problem. And this is why I think whilst Liverpool and you name a number of other clubs there might want to get David Alaba in the winter window, I think they'll have to wait until the summer, because, you know, you've mentioned there some key players. You mentioned Davies, you mentioned Pavard, you mentioned Kimmich, you mentioned Sula and Boateng. Well, David Alaba plays a centre-back, left-back or central midfielder, and pretty much the problems that Bayern have got at the moment are centrally and on the left-hand side. So yeah, it would be strange, I think, for Bayern to allow David Alaba to leave. So I can certainly see him agreeing terms with a club in the winter. But I would think that would be for a summer move. I can't see Bayern letting him go, because you're quite right. Sula's picked up an injury before, centre-back. Alaba can play there. Boateng, he's getting older and more injury-prone himself. Plays at centre-back or left-back. Well, they're the two areas that Alaba plays. Davies as well, left back. Pavard's a centre-back and a left-back and a right-back. Kimmich, right-back, defensive midfield, centre midfield. These are all areas that Alaba can play. And, of course, Alaba was playing left-back until Davies came in and he's been moved to centre and central. And Kimmich has been moved central as well. So these are key areas for Bayern that one player leaves. If Alaba does leave, there's three key areas that they've already got problems with, which is why I just can't see him going.
No, no doubt about it. Chris, we want to thank you for joining us on the show. Before we let you go, where can everyone find your work?
Well, you can find me. You can find my work in a various number of outlets. So I do co-commentary for the DFL, for the Bundesliga, on a weekend. So that's across the world. And then my written work is varying different formats, but you'll find them all advertised as such on my Twitter, which is Chris78Williams.
Perfect stuff. Thanks again for joining us. And we look forward to having you back very, very soon, my friend.
It's been great. Thanks for inviting me on. And yeah, look, I'll chat to you soon, hopefully.
Thanks again to Chris Williams for joining us on the show and having a great discussion about all things Bundesliga. Rob, we've got some great matches of the week coming up this week, even though we're still in the middle of a international break. We will be returning to normal world football. I want to preface the beginning by saying that the MLS playoffs are kicking on Friday and Saturday. So definitely there were too many matches to list one particular one. So Friday and Saturday, your first rounds of the MLS playoffs begin. Keep an eye out for that. On Tuesday, we go back to the European Nations League, where Spain and Germany are going to face off at 2:45 p.m. Then on Tuesday evening, we give you Uruguay, Brazil, and CONMEBOL World Cup qualifying at 6 p.m. On Wednesday, we have Belgium, Denmark in the Nations League kicking off at 2:45 p.m. Then we fast forward back to European club play with Friday, Monaco PSG, 3 p.m. on that one on Friday. Saturday sees top teams Liverpool and Leicester in the EPL kickoff at 10 a.m. We have Eintracht Frankfurt RB Leipzig kicking off at 12:30 p.m. on Saturday. And then the big one on Saturday afternoon, Atleti Barcelona, 3 p.m. Sunday will close us out with Napoli Milan in the Serie A at 2:45 p.m. Rob, you gave us a great trivia question at the beginning of the show. Can you please repeat it for us?
Absolutely. So looking at Chichi's reign as Brazil manager in the World Cup qualifiers, they've gotten 13 wins, 2 draws, no losses, 40 goals in favor, 5 goals against, and 41 points of a possible 45, so 91%. So amazing numbers for Chichi in the World Cup qualifying. So having said that, can you give me the ranking of the top 5 teams, obviously with Brazil included, of the 41 points, to have gained the most points ever since Chichi took in charge of Brazil?
So I owe you 4 teams, excuse me, and obviously Brazil is number 1 to start, so the 4 teams that I'm going to give you after. I'm hoping I've got these in order. I'm trying to remember how they finished for 2018 World Cup qualifying, because that's kind of where we need to be. And I'm going to give you the second team, and you know, my gut was to go Uruguay and then Argentina, but I'm actually going to flip it around, and I'm going to say Argentina was number 2.
Argentina was number 2 with 24 points.
Then I'm going to go Uruguay number 3.
Number 3 is also Uruguay with 24 points, but less of a goal difference.
Wow.
So, goals separate both Argentina and Uruguay on goal difference.
So I'm almost there of actually giving it to you in order, which was the extra bonus point.
Yep.
Okay, 4th place, I am going to go with Colombia.
It is not Colombia.
Ah! Is it Peru?
It is Peru.
Oh,
23 points.
was Colombia 5th?
It was. Colombia was 5th with 21 points.
Come on. It was so close. Yeah, I had it. When I wrote it down initially, as I was thinking about it, I wrote Uruguay, Argentina, Colombia, Peru. And then for some reason in my gut, I needed to switch Argentina, but I didn't think about switching Peru and Colombia. Ah, so if you want to give us the final answer, my friend, before we close this out.
So the top ranking is Brazil in first, obviously. Second is Argentina. Then it follows by Uruguay, Peru, Colombia, Chile, Paraguay, Ecuador, Venezuela, and Bolivia.
Your qualifiers for World Cup CONMEBOL qualifying. Ah, well, without any further ado and to save myself any further embarrassment, my friend, we'll hit the closing music.
Let's do it.
All right, here we go. So for episode 305 of Low Limit Football, special thanks again to Chris Williams for joining us. Next week, we will return to normal league action in the top five leagues. We'll give you a rundown of the MLS playoffs and how they're going so far. And we'll start to look back on Champions League as we get ready to kick off match day four. So for episode 305 of Low Limit Football, I am Joe Uccello.
I'm Roberto Rojas.
Thanks for listening, everyone, and good night.